We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics. Joining me today is Alfonso Picatiello, author of the Macro Compass Substack and co-host of the new podcast called The Macro Trading Floor. How are you today, Alf?
Hey, Tom, I'm good. I'm very happy to be back on the show.
It's great to have you back. I really enjoyed our conversation last time. And I'd like to start by, you know, obviously kind of addressing the title of your Substack. It's called The Macro Compass. So what are the polar stars of the macro indicators world that you like to use?
Yeah, Tom. So basically, I try to simplify the macro view of the world by using two main metrics. I use many more, but I look at these two in particular, and I put them in a compass. So in the end, it's a y-axis and an x-axis, right? In a compass that is then divided in four quadrants. And basically, as you can see from the chart, you have the two metrics, which are the global credit impulse and the relative monetary policy stance. Sounds all complicated. It's really not. So on top of the compass, you have the global credit impulse, and that effectively measures the pace of credit creation to the private sector, Tom. So that means how much money you and I are getting on our bank account at any point in time from either banks lending more money to us or the government, who all of a sudden decides we need to pay less taxes, we can get a stimulus check, et cetera, et cetera. And it measures the impulse. So how these bank accounts are changing in size in an accelerating or decelerating way. So again, it's not the Fed printing money. We're talking about the money you and I can really spend, right? That is what the credit impulse measures. Mm-hmm. This acceleration or deceleration in the spendable amount of money for the credit for the private sector. The relative monetary policy stance, on the other hand, measures what the Fed does, what the European Central Bank does, et cetera, et cetera. It measures how central banks are making the access to this credit less or more expensive at any point in time. Are they raising interest rates very fast or not? Are they signaling they will raise interest rates very fast? Are they doing QE? Are they doing QT, et cetera, et cetera? If you put these two metrics on a compass, you effectively end up in one of the quadrants, right? So, and at the moment, I would argue that we are in the bottom left quadrant where credit creation is decelerating. So we're going to the left of the quadrant, and the net monetary policy stance is also getting much tighter because central banks are beginning to withdraw all the support they've given to the economy over the last 2 years. You end up in the bottom left quadrant, which I call the just get away from everything quadrant, because, you know, when credit is becoming unavailable to the private sector all of a sudden because banks are not lending much, the government is not giving stimulus checks anymore, and at the same time, central banks are withdrawing accommodation. Wow, that's a very tough environment to invest, isn't it? Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in that situation, Alf, you're moving to a very defensive posture within your portfolio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. So, as I always say when I started a conversation, when I was in managing money before, I used to ask all these strategists and investment bankers, rather than your opinion, what are your trades? Mm-hmm. I always ask that. And so I ask myself the same question now, which is basically, what are my trades? And my trades today are basically to be short risk assets. I'm short the S&P 500. I'm short the credit spreads in the United States because I think they will widen because companies are very levered. They will have a hard time. I think house prices will stop going up very soon at some point. And so if you cannot short because you are an investor who is a long-only investor, typical, you know, retail guy, the advice I've been given since basically the beginning of the year is to increase your cash allocation. And if you're not based in the US, just buy some dollars if you can, because they will provide you with some additional protection compared to your domestic currency. Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot to get to there, Alf. And I'd like to, you know, spend some time getting through all of it. But, you know, as you said, you like to start your conversations by asking, or you used to start your conversations by asking, what's your trade? In a lot of your Macro Compass articles, you start with a quote. So one of your most recent quotes was, stability breeds instability because stability itself is destabilizing. And that was by Hyman Minsky. So what are you referring to when we think about this stability?
Great question, Tom. So Hyman Minsky was the father, basically, of the financial instability theory, if you wish. And he basically put up a theory out there by saying that when things get better all of a sudden, then credit gets thrown away to the private sector in an easier and easier and more relaxed way without many checks. And you know what it does? This increases economic activity, because when the private sector gets more credit at cheaper levels without much covenants, without much checks, right, they tend also to be able to then spend a lot of this credit they have received. And so economic activity picks up and you have this virtuous cycle, right? And things get better and better. And then new guys come in, new borrowers, because then credit conditions are getting better and banks want to lend even further. And this continues to move and move up on the risk ladder, although things look at that point very, very little volatile. You have credit spreads that don't move. Everything seems fine. It's basically 2005, 2006 again, right? That's exactly what it was back then. It seemed like nothing can go wrong. But Minsky teaches us that it's exactly this artificial stability that we create by compressing volatility, by these animal spirits that build up in the economy. And because of the excessive leverage we build up in these periods, this breeds instability. And instability then comes up with bouts, basically, of unpredictable volatility that make people have to deleverage all of their fancy models that assume to have no volatility, no drop in growth, no rise in unemployment, nothing of that. They actually need to revisit that model very fast. And, well, that causes quite a shake in the economy. We have seen a couple of these episodes happening. And at the moment, we are starting to witness the first cracks under the surface of this very low volatility environment. We were basically used to seeing 2016, 17, 18. We got some shakes at the end of 18, but then the Fed came back again, remember? And they said, no, guys, we can't have that. It's all going to be fine. We're going to support you. Another low volatility period in 2019, then 2020 came again. Big, exogenous shock, uncontrollable. And central banks took 2 months to calm everything down, and then again low volatility for a year and a half, and now problems are starting to brew under the surface again.
So when we think about those eras of, you know, calm financial markets and low volatility, I'd like to get your thoughts towards credit spreads and why they're an incredibly important signal to watch, and, you know, in some ways a real catalyst to seeing that period of low volatility really break up.
Yeah, so this is what I covered in my latest piece on the Macro Compass. I have a dedicated educational series. I was a fixed income 20 billion portfolio manager. So I know, I hope I know fixed income well enough to try and convey some educational content to my audience. It's all free, guys, if you want to check it out. It's called Bond Market 101 series. And we covered credit spreads in the latest piece. And I think they're very important and very underestimated, because how it works is if you look at a corporate bond yield, basically, Tom. So if you look at the mortgage rate or the private sector, like a corporate trying to get new funds, right? Like trying to lever, they pay the yield, which is composed by a treasury yield and a credit spread. Because obviously, if you want to lend money to a corporate, it's not as safe as lending money to the government. So you're going to demand some credit spreads to compensate you for this, credit worthiness of the or level of credit worthiness of the borrower, right? Which is inferior to the Treasury Department. So you're going to have basically to demand a credit spread to make up for that. And so when these credit spreads widen, what's happening is that, so they basically corporates have to pay a larger spread compared to the Treasury to borrow. What's really happening is that the market is demanding a higher premium for lending to these riskier corporates. What this makes again happen is that if a corporate, which is a highly levered business, has based their business on yields that are 3%, for example, in their leverage model, and all of a sudden they become 4% or 5% or 6%, which is what's happening now, they will need to revisit their investment assumptions, their CapEx assumptions. They will need to rethink their entire business model. And if this credit spreads widen enough, a lot of these companies lose access completely to the credit market. And when this freezes, like in 2018, late 2018, it froze for 57 days. High-yield U.S. corporates could not raise any funds on secondary markets and primary markets. That's bad. Because if they need to relever their business, they don't have an opportunity to do so. And what do? Then they start, you know, withdrawing their capex investments. They start to rethink about the size of the labor force. So credit spreads can have an impact as well on economic projections, on unemployment rates, et cetera. It's a quite an important indicator to watch. And today, investment grade and high yield credit spreads in the US are widening very aggressively, which is a signal that things are getting very tight for the private sector. And we should watch out. Also, mortgage rates have gone up very quickly from 3% to 5%. In the US, 30-year mortgage rates are above 5%, which makes borrowing to buy a house when salaries have not increased at the same pace at all, actually in real terms, salaries have gone down, it makes it prohibitively expensive for a US consumer to try and borrow and buy a house which has gone up 20% in value while his salary has not gone up by the same and mortgage rates have gone up by much. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, another, I guess, let's say a symptom of this time of stability was, as you were mentioning, this access to very, very cheap credit. So how are some of these zombie companies and by extension, the S&P going to be affected by this tightening of the credit markets?
Yeah, very bad. It's my take to answer in very short format your question. Mm-hmm. Many of these business models that are not really business models of these zombie companies, low-rated junk companies in the US, have basically been kept afloat by the fact they could borrow on an overall yield which was as low as 3 or 4% in the US, summing up treasury yields, which are very low, and credit spreads, which are also low on top of it. So the overall spread, overall bond yield, corporate yield for a junk company was very low. Mm-hmm. Now, if you make a highly leveraged, non-very profitable business, have to lever up at 6% instead of 3%, as we discussed, Tom, then seriously, a lot of these guys will have to go out of business or seriously risk so. And so you're going to see default rates start picking up a bit. And, you know, this has a second-round impact as well on the economy and on earnings. And the S&P 500, obviously, will suffer because the same companies that have, you know, problems in refinancing the cheaper rates will probably have problems keeping their leverage in their balance sheet, will affect their earnings, and therefore will also affect their equity prices at the end of the day. But Tom, this is what the Fed wants. I want to stress this point. The Federal Reserve has an inflation problem. We all know that. Thanks, Alf. Nothing new here. But what people don't understand is that the Federal Reserve has basically no control on the supply side of the inflation story. They cannot make the ships that are stuck at the Shanghai port to load or discharge more quickly and bring all their chips and the commodities and whatever comes from China around. They can't do that. They cannot make Russia and Ukraine stop a war so that Russia can export energy more easily or Ukraine can export wheat or corn. They can't do that. What they can do is to make sure that the demand side of the equation slows down. And how do you slow the demand side of the equation in an effective way? Is you calm animal spirits down. You make corporates rethink their business model. You make people rethink about buying a third and a fourth house because mortgage rates are very low. You make their 401ks a bit lower, even possibly by making the S&P 500 go down. So they rethink their consumer habits. Mm-hmm. That's what they're planning to do. And they told us very explicitly they would.
Alf, as we're talking about this, I'm wondering if there are maybe some of the indexes that would be more affected by this. Let's say if the NASDAQ has more companies that are really dependent on this cheap credit cycle versus the S&P. Do you see that as a possibility?
So it's a good question, Tom. I think if I look into the composition, then the weakest links from a credit perspective are in the Russell 2000. So that's more the small cap sort of companies that are really relying on some leverage and some earnings to come in. So they need cyclical growth to be very strong and they are relatively leveraged.
Okay.
So they're not doing that well. But on the other hand, don't think the mega cap and the S&P 500 of these worlds are doing much better because they have another problem. So the Federal Reserve told us that they want to tighten financial conditions. That it's very complicated jargon they used to basically say we need to slow down demand, guys. If you look at the components of the financial condition index, you find a couple of stuff: the dollar, real interest rates, credit spreads, and equities. Now, the dollar has been going up, and a lot of these mega cap stocks have earnings that are delivered outside the US. And so when the dollar goes up, it hurts already some of their profitability this way. Mm-hmm. Second problem is real interest rates. These companies in the Nasdaq, in the S&P, they generally have very high multiples. And these high multiples are basically a reflection of the fact that the cash flows they're able to generate, basically, if you discount them at a very low real interest rate, then these cash flows are pretty valuable, even if they're down the future. Because, you know, if your alternative is to put money in a treasury that is yielding nothing, actually negative in real terms, then you'd better invest in a company that even in a few years will deliver some very large earnings, right? Now reverse the situation. Real interest rates have gone up pretty aggressively in the US. Actually, they're now positive. So if you're an investor that want to invest in a 10-year treasury and you look at 10-year inflation expectation, today you're buying a 10-year treasury at about 3%. The inflation expectation over the next 10 years are 2.7%. So you are supposed to lock in positive real rates. Mm-hmm. Now, why would you want to buy a company at those valuations? Why would you want to pay that premium if you at least have now an alternative to preserve your purchasing power in a safe instrument? So these companies have a dollar problem and have a valuation problem because real rates have been going up, and therefore the discounting factor of their future cash flows has gone up, which makes their present value, so their stock price basically, in an equilibrium stage to become lower, which is what we're seeing happening. Basically, Tom, very complicated answer to say, it's a very difficult to find a place where to hide in such an environment, as we showed on the Macro Compass before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'd like to get to that part of, you know, where you think all of these different asset classes are headed. But I'd like to stay on the macro side a little bit more here. One of the other pieces you wrote, you kind of came up with a new term of a global macro vigilante. So why don't we start by explaining what a bond vigilante was, because I'm sure most of our listeners would be familiar with that term and when they were active.
So the bond vigilantes term was invented by Edward Yardeni, which is a Wall Street economist, still active today, publishes a lot of stuff, very cool guy. And he basically referred to the bond vigilantes, you know, in the 80s, in the 90s, where a lot of countries were running some fiscal largesse when it comes to their deficit policies. And then on the monetary side as well, perhaps they were contributing to this largesse. And then you had bond vigilantes coming in. You had these guys telling them, no, you can't do that, or inflation will go out of control. We will show you how it works by repricing your bond curve so that you guys start to behave, because you understand otherwise something is going to break. Mm-hmm. And those were the bond vigilantes. They understood and that they could basically exert their pressure and their power on policymakers to bring them towards discipline, fiscal and monetary discipline, right? Now, this bond vigilantes exercise has been watered down by QE over the last decade. Obviously, when you are supposed to be a guy who goes short on the bond market to try and signal to the policymakers things are not going the right way according to you, and they do QE, you're basically fighting against an elephant, the war you can't win, mm-hmm. right? So the bond vigilantes have gone on a holiday for a while. But what I argued in this piece is that the macro vigilantes seem to wake up a bit more. Because if you look at the bubbles brewing in different asset classes, perhaps some things are moving. And then I made the example, Tom, on FX, on the foreign exchange. So the yen has been moving very aggressively over the last month or so. And a lot of people are focused on the spot move. So they look at dollar against the yen, and you know the yen is tanking because the forward in dollar in terms of interest rate being priced in is much higher. And Japan is refusing to let go of their yield curve control. So it's diverging, which makes the dollar stronger against the yen, et cetera, et cetera. What I've been looking at in that piece is the volatility part of the segment. So basically, when all these central banks were applying similar policies at the same time, they were all together doing QE, keeping things very repressed, very calm, as we discussed before, the volatility, even in FX, both realized and implied, was very low. And now things are starting to move. So this implied volatility in these FX pairs starting to go up a bit, which makes me think, hey, maybe some macro vigilantes are coming in, starting to wake up to the fact that there might be a different regime ahead of us over the next 5 to 7 years. Mm-hmm.
So when we think about the yen being so decimated at this time, is it in some ways just a relative measurement, let's say, as the US dollar moves up, that is what is showing us relatively that the yen is getting crushed comparatively to it?
Yeah. So look, the yen is actually been depreciating against a bunch of other currencies. Against the dollar, it's pretty extreme because the dollar is leading this repricing when it comes to the central bank, which is telling you that they will try and tackle inflation very seriously. And on top of it, don't forget, Tom, that the dollar is the reserve currency of the world, which means that global trades happen mostly to be denominated in dollars. And there are a lot of borrowers out there that have used the euro dollar system to lever up in dollars, despite they have no dollar liquidity unless when it comes from trade flows. Take an emerging market, they borrow dollars like an emerging market corporates. They can lever up in dollars. They need dollar cash flows to come in. They need, you know, trade flows. They need the economy to go. And trade flows are now stopping because of supply bottlenecks. The economy is slowing down a bit. So what that corporate does, it goes back and tries to take some hands off on their dollars because they need to service their dollar liabilities. So the dollar is not only going up because the Fed is becoming tighter, but also because a lot of guys are levered up in dollar. The economy is slowing down. And as a result, you see people trying to get their hands on some dollars, right? Hmm. So the yen dollar move is exaggerated by the dollar lag. But the yen itself, let's talk about that for a second. Japan is a country that is trying to engineer any sort of inflation over the last 30 years without much success. The 20-year average of core inflation in Japan is 0.2% year on year. Tom, it's basically nothing. So when you tell these guys, oh, look, your currency is going down, are you worried? They're like, what? I mean, we'd love to see some inflation coming in because the yen is weakening. So we're going to import some inflation because our currency is weaker. They actually don't have a problem with that. What they have a problem with is a very disorderly drop in yen against all other currencies, like the one we're seeing, because then it sends the wrong signal to the population and to investors. That can be a bit scary. But at this moment, I think Japan is going to try to let the yen weaken a bit, even on a voluntary basis. Mm-hmm. They want to import some inflation. They've seen none at all over the last 20 years. Think about that. Mm-hmm.
So is that based on their real rate of return, or that's just their measured, almost CPI-like measurement? Yeah.
They have a Japanese CPI version of it. The other thing, of course, is that Japan has already tried everything we can imagine when it comes to levering up the private sector, doing deficits, plus the Bank of Japan buying all the bonds that the Japanese government was issuing. They have done the whole bunch, everything. And the result was that we have seen a massive asset market boom in Japan in the late 80s, the Japan miracle. Anybody wanted to buy Japan back then, until the central bank had an asset market problem. And then they decided to raise interest rates to calm things down. And then they ended up deflating the whole thing effectively. And then Japan slowly walked back into this very low growth, very low inflation regime. And they would really love, I think, to see some inflation back, which makes them relatively relaxed on this yen story so far, as long as it remains orderly between brackets.
So could the fall of the yen start to affect other currencies as well, and maybe the euro?
Yeah, so the yen plays a very important role, and Japan plays a very important role when it comes to global asset allocation. And why? Because Japan is a country that saves a lot. So it has a lot of internal savings to be allocated. And it's a country that is a capital exporter to the world. Because they are very trained in investing in foreign assets, because their domestic asset market is basically returning nothing. So they've learned over time to buy European bonds, US bonds, US equities, all of that. So when the yen moves, it makes for them the cost of hedging the FX risk when they buy foreign assets. What they do is they take the yen, they sell it, they buy the dollars, and with the dollars, they buy dollar bonds, right? But they still have a risk because don't forget, they sold the yen and they bought the dollar to do this operation. So what they do is they try to hedge this FX risk. And when the yen moves, obviously it makes this risk reward change a bit. So it is important to monitor what happens to the yen to also understand what Japan will do as a capital exporter nation. For instance, today, if Japan would buy a treasury bond from America and they will try to hedge the FX risk, so they only want the return from the bond, but no FX risk, they will end up having a worse yield than simply buying their non-yielding Japanese government bond, which makes you think about how important it is to monitor these FX moves. I explained that in one of the articles on the Macro Compass. Because if Japan stops being the marginal buyer of US treasuries, they are the largest owners of US treasuries in the world. It's not China, it's Japan. So it's important to know actually what Japan will be doing when it comes to US treasury bonds as well, and US assets and European assets too. Mm-hmm.
So when we think about, let's say, the headwinds facing Europe right now, are they really being affected by this slowdown in global growth? And do you expect to see a recession there before the US?
Yes, I expect Europe to fall in recession before the US does. I actually expect Europe to fall in recession this year already. If you ask me, there is a very harsh combination in Europe where you already have, like the US, wages in an inflation adjusted terms being negative. So people's purchasing power is going down in Europe on an inflation adjusted basis for already a year, year and a half. Then you have the energy situation. Europe is very exposed to Russia as an energy importer from Russia, and they're having a hard time dealing with that. And so that is something that is denting European GDP and confidence even further. And on top of that, of course, the euro is starting to reflect that, right? It's starting to reflect a place that is already a low growth and is an energy importer, and it's being punished for being one. And so Europe is actually, I think, facing this combination that is pretty nasty, and it's going to lead them into a recession. Fun stuff, or not really fun stuff, but unusual stuff for Europeans, and I am one, is that normally when something like that would happen, like a recession or a very harsh slowdown in growth, the European Central Bank will come in and rescue the whole thing and ease conditions, and now they can't. Core inflation in Europe printed at 3.5%. Never seen anything like that. 3.5% core. So stripped from energy prices, food prices, just core inflation, 3.5% year on year. What's worse, inflation expectations are very high as well. For the next 5 years, traders expect in Europe, again, 3.5% inflation on average. If you are the European Central Bank with a target at 2% and you see spot the 3.5 and the next 5 years being priced at 3.5 as well, how can you ease, Tom? How can you ease conditions? You're not credible. You're going to lose your credibility completely. The small one you have left, if you ask me. So this is a very dangerous situation. And I think because the European Central Bank can't help here, that Europe is bound to fall into a recession this year. Mm-hmm.
You know, we were talking earlier, Alf, about, let's say, the bond issuers that get downgraded. Mm-hmm. Is there any risk to central banks of being downgraded in their creditworthiness as well?
Well, that's a very interesting question. So I'm going to say something pretty strong here, which is a central bank basically is an arm of the government, which is mandated to regulate commercial banks and to provide liquidity to commercial banks. So basically it oversees the functioning of the commercial banking system. Mm-hmm. And as such, being an arm of the government, mandated by the government to do so, although they're considered to be separate in today's interpretation, but they are ultimately mandated by the government, you are effectively asking whether a government can be downgraded by issuing its own money. That's effectively the question, what it boils down to. And money is a construct of trust. And let's say it is considered to be a mean of exchange that preserves somehow the value between economic agents that choose that mean to transact against each other. Now, if that faith remains, Tom, then there is nothing you need to downgrade, because a government is always able to print its own currency. It's very simple. Now, when you ask about a central bank, then by definition, a central bank does that in its own currencies. That's why I'm asking, talking about the government, right? Which is ultimately what we're discussing in the end. So if the public opinion continues to deem that currency as a proper mean of exchange, there is nothing that we need to downgrade. If you bring the experiment of real rates to very negative levels and financial repression to extremely dangerous levels, then there is a risk that this experiment might lead to some bad consequences. Today, central banks, if you think about it, they're doing the opposite. They're trying to bring real interest rates towards more acceptable and higher levels, again, to try and tighten financial conditions and make this whole thing disappear, basically. So I think this is not the moment where this will lead to a downgrade of credibility in the governments being able to issue their own currency.
And, you know, in that vein, Alf, you're just talking about the Fed really going into tighten monetary policy. And I've heard you say before that they're going to hike until something breaks. So what do you think would constitute something breaking?
Well, it can be plenty of things. I would say that if I look at the overall situation today, what will make the Fed really pivot? And it's hard for them. Imagine, I mean, inflation is 8%. Mm-hmm. I mean, what do they want to pivot? It's the same situation as the ECB, but even worse. I mean, how can they with a straight face come up and say we're going to accommodate? I mean, it's sorry. The only thing I think that will really make them think twice is if the treasury market or the repo market functioning will be seriously impaired. So because effectively that represents the first layer of money, repo, euro dollars, the treasury, they represent basically the backbone of our financial system. A treasury is not nothing else but government's money. So if government money is not exchanged on a very liquid basis, treasury bonds, and there is a very functioning repo market behind, then a lot of things don't work. So we have seen in 2019 that the repo market broke and then the Federal Reserve came in and immediately fixed that, right? I think they're extremely attentive to that. They've set up a facility which is called SRF, so the repo facility, basically, which is always there. It's always standing. It's a standing repo facility. And that serves the purpose of trying to backstop any large nervousness in repo market and in treasury markets. If you know, the market functioning would get as bad as that even doesn't work, then I think that is a signal that something is breaking really bad and that would make them think twice. When it comes to the usual things breaking really bad, credit markets, equities, and all of that, Tom, I don't think that their pain point is very low at this stage. Because of what we just discussed, they have an inflation problem. That's their enemy number one, two, and three. And if the equity markets drop another 10%, I'd just be like, I'm sorry, guys, but we have another problem here. Our mandate is not the S&P. Our mandate here is to make sure that you guys believe that inflation is going to be anchored around 2%. And you seem to start to have some doubts around that. And our job as the Fed is to make sure you don't have many doubts about that.
So, you know, we talked about the rise in interest rates here, and you kind of touched on how that could affect the housing market. Is that really the only thing that the housing market is, let's say, most sensitive to, is just the interest rate?
So the housing market, let me give some context, because it is an important question, Tom. The housing market, the real estate market, actually, summing up housing market, commercial real estate, and agricultural land, is by far the biggest asset class in the world. Shown that already on the macro compass, it's about $300 trillion. And do you know how much is the equity market? That's 120 something trillion dollars. Mm-hmm. And it's 300. So we're talking like, people look at the equity market and they say, okay, this is the biggest ever asset class. Not really, the real estate market is much bigger. And it is much bigger because of leverage. Because people can just lever up very easily against their income for the next 30 years, and they can just get a mortgage and get money from a bank they didn't have and buy a house, right? And so that makes the real estate market being big, systematic, and also very large because of leverage. Okay. Now, leverage implies that if interest rates move, Tom, then things start to change very quickly. A very leveraged market, when interest rates go up and down, it starts to move as well very quickly. And so the answer is, I think interest rates are very important for the real estate market, but supply is also important. So, of course, if you dry up supply completely, there is no inventory, nobody wants to sell, because if I sell my house, I need to buy a new one, most likely a place where to live. And a place where to live, if the mortgage rates are very high, then I can't afford it, so I'd rather not sell. Mm-hmm. So let's say the supply dries up there is no new inventory because home builders have a problem. Then temporarily, even if interest rates have gone up so fast in such a high leveraged market, prices have a hard time dropping because there is no supply, right? So you need to keep that in mind. But medium term, the marginal price setter is actually the guy who's able to afford a new house anyway. So where is the demand coming from? If salaries are stagnating in real terms and interest rates have gone up so much, making borrowing so much more expensive, I think housing here is looking relatively fragile. So I wouldn't expect another 10-20% increase in house prices this year. wherever you are, Europe, Canada, the US, wherever you are, I think this is a moment where to expect house prices at best plateau. Actually, I expect them to drop a bit this year by about 5 to 7%. And then it will really depend about how things develop further. What have central banks achieved their objective? Have they lowered inflation enough to be able to ease things down a bit? Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, we were also speaking earlier about, you know, really getting defensive. So what does that mean to you? Like, how does that affect, let's say, gold? And is it only cash at this point that is, you know, despite being eaten away by inflation, maybe a good bet?
Yeah, you know, it makes me relatively uncomfortable to have raised my cash allocation by mm-hmm. large percentages like I did in my medium-term portfolio. Tactically, I'm even short risk assets. But again, let's assume you cannot do leverage or short, so you can just have a long-only portfolio. Basically, everything you bought this year, unless apart to if you were smart enough to buy some commodities, anything else has lost you more money than just the money that cash has lost you because inflation has gone up at the same time, right? So it's more of a capital preservation play, actually, than it is trying to make money. And so people should understand that there are cycles as well in the economy. There are moments where you can be more aggressive, moments where you have to be more defensive. This is just the moment to play defense, to be honest. And how do you play that? In a long-term asset allocation model, normally you look for uncorrelated assets. So you're like, okay, if this goes up, this goes down, and then overall my portfolio is balanced. And this uncorrelated asset should also be able to provide additional source of return. So the ideal asset is uncorrelated and it adds returns to portfolio. Sorry, guys, but I can't find many today because when you tighten conditions so fast, so quick, everything that has involved leverage, bonds, credits, equities, any risk asset basically suffers all at the same time. And the correlation goes to one. So it's very difficult to find an alternative at this stage.
So Alf, do you have an ultimate target, let's say, for when you think gold or some of these, you know, safe haven assets will be good to enter again? Or is that more of a, you know, an overall risk within the market situation that you're going to be monitoring?
So basically, there will be one point, as I said a couple of times on the macro compass, things need to get worse before they get better. Which means that in these environments, like in the most similar environment is in Q4 2018, where, do you remember? I mean, like equity drawdown 20%, gold went down, anything went down, bonds were selling off. There was nothing that worked mm-hmm. basically back then. And that's because conditions were tightening so fast and, you know, just it doesn't work, nothing works. And we are now in these environments, and how things get better then is effectively because it's capitulation, and then at some point the Federal Reserve needs to come in. At some point they need to come in, right? And this point this time is much, you know, more complicated than it was in Q4 18 because inflation back then was 2% and now it's 8%. The other way for things like gold to be very attractive, very funnily, is if inflation slows down. So let me try to elaborate. If inflation slows down now pretty fast, let's assume that happens. That means that the Federal Reserve can be like, okay, actually, it's not as bad as we thought. Inflation is slowing down. We are not that worried anymore, right? Mm-hmm. We can eat things. And as a lot has been priced in, there is like 300 basis points of tightening being priced in over the next 12 months. I mean, wow, that's a lot by any standard. If you start to reprice some of that away, just by doing that, as inflation is coming down, nominal yields will come down faster because the Federal Reserve path will be repriced down to be much less aggressive than it is today. What happens when real interest rates go down because inflation is coming down, but nominal yields are coming faster down? Gold goes up. That's what we learn it happens. So very paradoxically for gold at this stage, I would say it makes more money if inflation slows down to a point that the Fed can just relax a bit and chill out, and some of this very strong tightening gets priced out by markets. So either things have to get worse before they get better, or inflation has to slow down very aggressively here, and then gold becomes a great investment. But for now, you just have to be patient. And as always, there are cycles where things go up and things go down. And my main take is that this is the cycle where to be defensive because things are going down.
Mm-hmm. Alfred, are there going to be any other asset classes that you think are going to be really attractive to you other than gold when we get back to that place?
Yes. So obviously, stocks are going to look very good because ultimately, as real yields will be going down, the future cash flows will be more valuable. And also, people will reprice that earnings at some point will start picking up again because you're going to make borrowing cheaper for the companies. You're going to make, you know, again, you're going to have this virtuous cycle unfolding. So stocks are going to be looking good. Bonds, obviously, are going to be looking good because as you reprice, you know, the reaction function of the Fed to be much less aggressive, then you can own bonds that are priced to be instead at 3% maybe, and you're never going to see 3% if we see this pivot happening because inflation is slowing down. So that is basically the point where there are a lot of things that look good at that point, basically. Gold looks very good because you will be early in the cycle. So you don't have a full visibility on the fact that the economy will pick up already, but you have visibility on the fact that real yields are going to be coming down again. And so in that early stage, gold does very well and bonds do very well. And then equities ultimately will do very well again. But before we get to that very rosy environment, unfortunately, we either need things to get worse before they get better, or we need inflation to slow down very aggressively. At this stage, it is very hard to predict. Supply bottlenecks are still very strong. There are 800 ships stuck at the port of Shanghai, trying to load or discharge anything they have. The supply chain is very, very tight. I've shown also a chart that shows New York Fed Global Supply Chain Pressure Index, which is at the highest level over the last 25 years by a mile. It's showing that really the supply chain is becoming more and more impaired. The war between Russia and Ukraine doesn't seem to come to an end, which means that things like neon is a gas which Ukraine exports for 70 to 80% of the entire world, and semiconductor chips manufacturer use that gas to produce it. And if they can't get their hands on their gas, then the semiconductor chips are going to become unavailable. They are used in everything, Tom, in our computer, medical devices, cars. So what's going to happen? You impair the supply chains further, make the price of these things more expensive, and inflation basket keeps on going up. So it is very difficult to predict when inflation is going to slow down, let alone slow down hard enough to convince the Fed that they don't need to tighten further. So I'm afraid, indeed, things need to get worse before they get better.
Alf, do you think that there's any risk of any type of a deflationary event coming because any of these issues that we're seeing today really break and cause a deflationary condition to start?
So if the things need to get worse before they get better, actually is the theory we're going for, because inflation is not going to slow down. There is obviously a risk that we are going to overdo this tightening. And so there is going to be a deleveraging mechanism, which is much larger than we think. So asset prices will go down by much more than people are used to, including real estate prices. And that obviously has a disinflationary impact, which can be pretty strong, coupled with the fact that demand side will be very weak. So there is no government handouts. There is no push to cyclical demand. There can be a period of relatively strong disinflationary push if the tightening is really that excessive that it causes deleveraging in very large fashion, then that can happen. And that is actually what policymakers really don't want to see. Because in a world of very high leverage, if there is deflation, then you're making the debt load more expensive to pay in real terms, which is really not what the system is based on, the exact opposite. Mm-hmm. You make more leverage and you make it cheaper to access and cheaper to repay by making the real borrowing cost, the real servicing cost of this debt lower and lower and lower. In a deflationary environment, you're making this bigger and bigger and bigger of a problem, which is exactly what policymakers don't want. But hey, they also didn't want inflation at 8%, then they have it. So you can never discharge possibilities, actually.
Mm-hmm. Excellent, Alf. Well, I really appreciate you running us through all of these different macro factors as only you can in some ways. Of course, your Substack is excellent, the macrocompass.substack.com, and all of your stuff is linked to it from your Twitter as well, at macroalf. Is there anything else you want to touch on before we wrap up today?
Yes, there is no reason why you shouldn't subscribe to Tom's YouTube channel, guys. I want to shout out at him. This is one of the best shows. I've invited too many, but Tom does a fantastic job. So subscribe to his channel. please, because you know, it's high quality content pushed out regularly by Tom and the team.
Well, thank you very much, Alf. I really appreciate that. And I would say the same for any listeners that are interested in getting a bit more broader of a view and understanding how, for example, the bond market works. And of course, you have something really interesting. You do a short podcast, almost like an audio version of the articles that you write. So if you're more of an audiophile like I am, and you prefer listening to something versus reading it, Alf provides that for you as well. Alf, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it. Talk soon.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.